This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos-Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delga.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll have a live report with Colorado journalist Alan Best giving background on the firebombing incident in Vail, which has resulted in a mass roundup of activists.
Democratic representatives are saying that the Department of Homeland Security is not meeting a number of its promises to protect the country.
And the United Nations has rejected a plea among Sunni groups to hold another vote amidst charges of election fraud.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,172 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,115 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Natural gas might depend on some expensive and contentious options. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. The United States has 5 port facilities that can handle tankers full of liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
In the nation in recognizing today's 32nd anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. Wildlife conservation groups are saying since the adoption of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, only 7 of the over 1,200 rare animals, plants, and fish it protects have been lost to extinction. Christine Corrant with the Oregon Natural Resources Council says the law has helped preserve Oregon's character.
We're preserving Oregon's wild and beautiful forests and rivers and the wildlife that call those places home. It's a chance for Oregonians to get to live in this beautiful environment that we love and cherish, and we share it with the wildlife that enjoys that same land.
The anniversary comes at a time when the protections of the Act are under attack. In an effort to streamline federally funded projects on public lands, Congress is considering weakening several environmental laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act. Corrant says the Endangered Species Act is a gift that keeps on giving.
32 years ago, the President and Congress gave America this amazing gift protecting wildlife like bald eagles and coho salmon. And this courage and vision ensures that a century from now, Americans will have the same opportunity to enjoy these beautiful and amazing animals.
This is Andrew Norris with KBOO News.
Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 28, 2005. I'm Spencer Raymond.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Oregon Wildfire and Wilderness Groups are joining their counterparts across the nation to commemorate today's 32nd anniversary of America's Endangered Species Act. But it comes at a time when the wildlife protection law is under attack in Congress. KBOO's Andrew Norris reports.
Oregonians are joining the nation in recognizing today's 32nd anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. Wildlife conservation groups are saying since the adoption of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, only 7 of the over 1,200 rare animals, plants, and fish it protects have been lost to extinction. Christine Corrant with the Oregon Natural Resources Council says the law has helped preserve Oregon's character.
We're preserving Oregon's wild and beautiful forests and rivers and the wildlife that call those places home. It's a chance for Oregonians to get to live in this beautiful environment that we love and cherish, and we share it with the wildlife that enjoys that same land.
The anniversary comes at a time when the protections of the Act are under attack. In an effort to streamline federally funded projects on public lands, Congress is considering weakening several environmental laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act. Courant says the Endangered Species Act is a gift that keeps on giving.
32 years ago, the President and Congress gave America this amazing gift protecting wildlife like bald eagles and coho salmon. And this courage and vision ensures that a century from now, Americans will have the same opportunity to enjoy these beautiful and amazing animals.
This is Andrew Norris with KBOO News.
Local activists are on edge over relations that the federal government has engaged in illegal spying activities for the past several years. Portland attorney Paul Loney is live on the phone to talk about the history of local activists under surveillance, as well as to give a few tips for those who worry about their own civil rights. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Hey, you're welcome.
First, give us some background on surveillance of local activists. I mean, is there any history of that in Portland?
Well, yeah, back in the Vietnam War days, they monitored protests to see if people were planning to storm draft centers to try and destroy the draft records, recruiting centers. That's pretty clear in all the records that have been released in the time since then. And during the Bush protest days, and even when Clinton was here, people protesting, they would have people in the crowd dressed as activists monitoring things to see if the crowd would somehow do something they didn't like. You know, they had walkie-talkies sort of hidden in their backpacks, but it was pretty easy to pick out who the people that pretended they were activists that weren't. And even when people were protesting the Trojan shutdown because of the whole nuclear power issue, they were worried about activists somehow doing something with nuclear power, which is kind of laughable.
Now, what are some of the biggest violations of civil rights on that issue that you know of in Portland?
Well, of course, here that Brandon Mayfield. That whole thing was such a fiasco, and poor Mr. Mayfield and what he went through in his family, where they just went in, you know, they go into his home and searched his home without telling him, and started monitoring his mail and his email, his computer records, and what his children were doing in school. That was pretty amazing.
Now, Paul, I mean, does it matter if someone is engaged in illegal activity, or, I mean, can any legal, political organization or speech trigger an investigation or covert spying?
Well, what they're always worried about is that something that's legal becoming illegal, and then they're always paranoid about that. I mean, people have the right to protest. You have the right to redress your grievances, and so they're always trying to infiltrate these protests and to either spin it the way they want to or sort of nip it in the bud by telling people to do something illegal so they can stop it and arrest the leaders right away before it gets out of hand, in their words.
Now, what should people do if they worry that they could be caught up in a situation like this?
Well, if someone they don't know or only know slightly starts to suggest something illegal, I would state very loudly that I never participate in illegal activities. That way, if there's any tape recorders, hidden wires picking up, that you're on the record as soon as this person brought it up saying, I don't participate in illegal activities and I don't support them. Just so you're on record, if they're taping it, that you said that.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul. That was Portland attorney Paul Loney.
You're welcome.
The village was established to house people who couldn't get into the city's crowded homeless shelters. It used to be a collection of tents and tarps. Now it has a set of portable houses. The agreement would let the village manage the site in northeast Portland, while police and fire departments would have oversight. The village would have to keep track of who lives there and be financially self-sufficient with the help of private fundraising. Advocates for the homeless decried a lack of accountability in ensuring that village residents were moving into permanent housing. Others complained about allowing the homeless to camp on public property.
The National Weather Service in Portland has issued a flood watch through Thursday afternoon, saying the Clackamas, Tualatin, Sillets, Sinslaw, Mary, and Pudding Rivers represent the greatest concern for flooding. On the Oregon coast, rain was expected with winds of 30 to 40 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 70 miles per hour, starting in the middle of the night. In addition to uprooted trees and possible power failures, coastal towns should expect up to 3/4 inch of rain today, according to the forecast. Meanwhile, the Coast Range could get 1.5 inches of rain, and the Willamette Valley anywhere from 0.5 inch to 1 inch. The worst of the latest storm is expected to pass by sunset tonight, but it may take another day for the rivers to respond, Weather Service officials said. Alan Best is a Colorado-based journalist who covered the firebombing of a Vail ski development expansion project in 1998. Writing for High Country News, Best recently updated his reporting on the issue in light of the arrests of several Oregon environmentalists charged with terrorism. He joins us now on the phone to give some background on the story. Alan, thanks for talking with us. Can you hear us, Alan? We appear to be having some technical difficulties with our connection with Alan, but we will return to him as soon as possible. In the meantime, we'll move on to our next story. Oregon Social Services face a huge cut because of fiscal mismanagement in the Department of Human Services. KBU's Sheila Whiteside, has the story.
Oregon's biggest state agency, the Department of Human Services, has $172 million less than it says it needs. Officials say Tuesday that cutting the budget could force reductions in health care and other services to the poor. The budget hole is larger than the legislature's emergency board can cover. The board, which gives money to agencies when the legislature is not in session, has about $29 million available. And some legislators suggest that a special session may be necessary to ensure the agency remains able to provide crucial services. The DHS director says he failed to correctly forecast the increase in demand for health care through the Oregon Health Plan, especially among programs that provide services to the elderly, blind, disabled, and low-income adults and children. The budget the legislature passed in August was based on caseload data that was more than 5 months old. For KBU News, I'm Sheila Whiteside.
I've just been informed that Alan Best is on the line with us. To recap, Alan covered the story of the Vail firebombing and has recently revisited that issue in light of the arrests of several environmentalists, including some from Oregon. He joins us now on the phone. Alan, thank you very much. No, once again, Alan is not with us, so we will delay this indefinitely. All right, moving on. The time is 5:12, and now on today's Earthwatch report, how a rising demand of natural gas might lead to an increase of liquefied gas.
Future supplies of natural gas might depend on some expensive and contentious options. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. The United States has 5 port facilities that can handle tankers full of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Industry is counting on more of these facilities to handle increasing imports of this fossil fuel as North American resources are depleted. But Julian Darley says banking on LNG is an expensive and risky idea.
Why would anyone want to liquefy natural gas? After all, you have to get it down to minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a complex, energy-intensive engineering operation. And by the time you've piped the gas from the producing camp to the coast, put it into a liquefactual terminal, got it into a ship, which is an extremely expensive ship too, sailed it across the ocean, and then put it into an expensive regasification plant. This is a multi-billion dollar thing to do.
Darley is the author of a new book, High Noon for Natural Gas. He says most people don't want LNG import terminals near their cities because of the danger of accidents or terrorism.
Once you start bringing in LNG, you've got the problem of where to site the importing terminals, which is proving a pretty difficult matter in North America. But even if you've got your import terminals, you've got another problem. Where does the gas come from?
Darley says competition for more gas is already heating up between industrial nations.
Everybody else has got natural gas woes, so everybody is thinking about bringing in LNG.
You...
The current time is 5:14. Still to come on the KBU Evening News, a conservative group is airing television commercials that suggest that the White House was right all along and that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction. The energy ministries of Ukraine and Russia have failed to resolve a dispute over Russia's plan to increase the price of gas exports to Ukraine. And Shaq And will Shaq come back, sumo style? You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River. Federal applications for a special U.S. court to authorize secret surveillance rose sharply after the September 11, 2001 attacks, and the panel required changes to the requests at an even greater rate, government documents now show. President Bush acknowledged this month that he had secretly ordered the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on international phone conversations and email of Americans suspected of links to terrorists without approval from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, also known as FISA. The document spying order has set off a furious debate over whether the war on terrorism gives President Bush a blank check when it comes to civil liberties and whether the president, in fact, broke the law. The Justice Department's reports to the U.S. Congress on the surveillance court's activities show that the Bush administration made 5,645 applications for electronic surveillance and physical searches through 2004, the most recent year for which figures are available. In the previous 4 years, the court received a total of 3,436 such requests. Bush said he had reauthorized the domestic spying program more than 30 times since the September 11th attacks and would continue to do so in the future. The National Archives released about 300 additional documents today concerning Justice Samuel Alito's service in the Justice Department during the Reagan administration. The press and advocacy groups will undoubtedly spend the next few days scouring through the pages for new details before Alito's confirmation hearing that begins in less than 2 weeks. But for many of the largest civil rights groups in the country, there is already much known about the Supreme Court nominee that has them opposing Alito's nomination. From Free Speech Radio News, Mitch Jezeris has more from Washington.
From the NAACP to the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund to one of the nation's largest disability rights groups, the National Council on Independent Living, President Bush's pick to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court, Judge Samuel Alito, is facing opposition from the country's largest civil rights groups. Many of these same groups oppose John Roberts as Chief Justice, whose confirmation sailed through the Senate.
We are convinced that he would move the court substantially to the right in a way that is inimical to the interests of African Americans and people of color and civil rights and human rights.
Theodore Shaw heads the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He says that as a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, Alito rarely ruled in favor of minorities when concerning workplace discrimination cases.
In the employment discrimination area, we looked at dozens and dozens of cases in which he sat in review of lower court opinions, or decisions rather, and in only two cases involving African Americans did he rule in favor of African American claimants. Only two out of dozens and dozens. What that means is that as a rule, our clients, our constituency, we don't believe that they will win or have much of a chance of winning before him.
Shaw says Alito's record in the mid-80s while with the Justice Department is also troubling. Throughout his career, Alito has tended to side with law enforcement when concerning police force and the Fourth Amendment right against unlawful searches.
When he was in the federal government, for example, before he became a judge, there was a case that the Legal Defense Fund litigated involving a 15-year-old unarmed burglar who in Memphis broke into a house and was shot in the back by a police officer, shot in the head, back of the head rather, and killed. And the case went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said you can't use deadly force to stop a fleeing unarmed felon. But the memorandum he wrote in the Justice Department indicated that he would have given the police officer not only the benefit of the doubt, but would have found it to be acceptable.
Alito is also facing opposition from the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. MALDEF opposes Alito for his decision as a judge, allowing for the dismissal of Spanish-speaking jurists when the defendant was a Spanish speaker, and for his memo indicating he believed that undocumented immigrant children did not have a right to an education, even after the Supreme Court ruled otherwise. Anne Marie Tallman is the president of MALDEF.
In his memoranda to the FBI director on a question related to whether undocumented immigrants had constitutional rights, he ignored that case law altogether. 4 years had passed at the writing of the memo since the decision Plyler versus Doe had been decided, which is a MALDEF case, and we find that very troubling that he would ignore case law that was right on point and use older, more strained case law to make a point that immigrants that are undocumented did not have constitutional protections for non-fundamental rights.
The disability rights group, the National Council on Independent Living, is also weighing in with its opposition to Alito. Nichols Executive Director John Lancaster says Alito has a track record of ruling against disability rights in housing laws.
One was a 1990 ruling, ADAPT versus HUD, in which he gave a free pass to federal agency to ignore their own rules and regulations requiring accessible housing units and requiring fair treatment of people with disabilities in terms of applying for housing supports and access to those accessible units. And here was a man that said, oh, they don't even have to do this, even though it's their own regulations and even though it's the law as passed by Congress.
Lancaster also cites a letter Alito wrote to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. with concerns that the U.N. Declaration for the Education of Disabled Children could violate state rights here in the United States. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
House Democrats charge that the Homeland Security Department has not kept 33 of its promises to better protect the country. A report released yesterday by 13 members of the House Homeland Security Committee says that nearly 3 years after the Cabinet Department's creation, gaps still remain in federal efforts to defend the nation against terrorism, including at ports, borders, and chemical plants. The department also fails to share alerts and other intelligence quickly with state and local officials, according to the Democrats' report, which analyzes public statements and congressional testimony that outlined Bush administration security goals since 2002. The Homeland Security Department officially opened its doors on March 2003. It was created in response to the September 11, 2001 terror attacks to bolster protections of potential domestic targets. Since then, according to the report, among other things, the department has failed to compile a list prioritizing protections for the nation's most vulnerable buildings and installing surveillance cameras at high-risk chemical plants.
Defense lawyers in some of the country's biggest terrorism cases say they plan to bring legal challenges to determine whether the National Security Agency used illegal wiretaps against several dozen Muslim men tied to Al-Qaeda. The lawyers said in interviews that they wanted to learn whether the men were monitored by the agency and, if so, whether the government withheld critical information or misled judges and defense lawyers about how and why the men were singled out. The expected legal challenges in cases from Florida, Ohio, Oregon, and Virginia add another dimension to the growing controversy over the agency's domestic surveillance program and could jeopardize some of the Bush administration's most important courtroom victories in terror cases, legal analysts say. While some civil rights activists, legal experts, and members of Congress have said President Bush did not have authority to order eavesdropping by the security agency without warrants, the White House and the Justice Department continued yesterday to defend the legality and propriety of the program.
All right, third time's the charm. We are joined now, we hope, by Alan Best, who is a Colorado-based journalist covering the firebombing of a Vail ski development. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with us. Folks, I don't know what to say. He's not there again. We will rejoin the story as soon as possible.
The Corporate Crime Reporter released a report today in which it analyzes the new policy by the Department of Justice to offer major corporations, including Adelphia, KMPG, Merrill Lynch, MCI, and others, special deals that allow prosecutors to not criminally prosecute corporations accused of wrongdoing. For Free Speech Radio News from Washington, D.C., Anastasia Naginsky has more on these non-prosecution agreements.
The report, called Crime Without Conviction, The Rise of Deferred and Non-Prosecution Agreements, details 34 special agreements that were established between corporations and the Department of Justice since June 2002, the last time when the company, Arthur Anderson, was actually convicted. The report finds that prosecutors have entered into twice as many non-prosecution and deferred prosecution agreements with major American corporations in the last 4 years than they have in previous 10 years. The author of the report, Russell Mockheiber, talks about one such agreement entered with KPMG Company.
In August of this year, KPMG, one of the Big Four accounting firms, admitted to criminally engaging in a fraud that generated at least $11 billion in phony tax losses, which cost the United States at least $2.5 billion in evaded taxes. Nonetheless, KPMG was granted a deferred prosecution agreement. At the press conference, which I attended at the Justice Department, announcing the deferred prosecution agreement, the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, said that KPMG, quote, has admitted to criminal wrongdoing in the largest ever tax shelter fraud. yet there was no criminal conviction.
Under a deferred prosecution agreement, the prosecutor charges cooperation with a crime, but agrees to drop the charge if the corporation fulfills its promises to the prosecutor, such as fines, cooperation, monitors, and indictment of particular executives. According to Mockheiber, these agreements set a trend for a dramatic shift in the prosecutorial practice in the U.S. when it comes to corporate crime.
10 years ago, it was save the individuals and plead the corporation. Now, the government has set up a system where it's save the corporation by sacrificing the individuals. So often what you see is the defense counsel cooperating with the prosecutor to save the corporation from a conviction, turning everything over about the executives and the executives being convicted.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
49 people have been indicted in a scam to pocket Red Cross hurricane relief funds, and more indictments are expected, according to Justice Department officials. Authorities said 22 people working for a Red Cross contractor at a call center in Bakersfield, California, filed false claims and, by involving family members and friends, brought the number of people under indictment to 49. McGregor Scott, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California, said about $200,000 in lost funds have been traced to the 49 people indicted and that the total is expected to reach between $300,000 and $400,000. Scott said most of the indictments involve charges of wire fraud and the possible penalties for conviction will depend on the degree to which the person was involved in the scam, the amount of money the suspect netted, and their prior criminal record. Red Cross workers said that because of the volume of calls, people were asked to provide only their name, address, and birth date. Call center agents would then have to confirm and approve those details before issuing a claim number so the evacuees could receive payment at a local Western Union outlet, $360 for individuals and more than $1,500 for families. In a reversal that transforms the criminal case against Enron's former top officials, the company's former chief accounting officer has reached an agreement with prosecutors to plead guilty to violating federal law during his employment there, people briefed on the decision said yesterday. The former accounting officer, Richard A. Causey, had been viewed by lawyers in the case as likely to strike a plea deal with prosecutors and possibly serve as a witness for the government in the coming trials of two former chief executives of Enron, Kenneth L. Lay and Jeffrey K. Skilling. Enron collapsed into bankruptcy in December 2001 amid questions about its widespread use of off-balance sheet partnerships to smooth and improve its reported financial performance. In the weeks and months that followed, evidence emerged of widespread abuse and misuse of accounting rules at Enron as the company struggled with an array of poor business decisions that weighed down its financial performance. Causey would be the 16th person with ties to the company to plead guilty to committing crimes. Many members of the company's once-celebrated senior management team have already pled guilty, including Andrew Fastow, who is scheduled to appear as a witness in the cases against Mr. Lay and Mr. Skilling.
Texas's top criminal court agreed to consider U.S. Representative Tom DeLay's motion for a speedy trial on money laundering charges. The State Court of Criminal Appeals, in a decision released late yesterday, gave Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle 1 week to submit a written response to the motions filed by lawyer Dick DeGuerin on behalf of the former U.S. House Majority Leader. DeLay has been seeking a quick resolution of the money laundering and conspiracy charges. He had to temporarily give up his majority leader post after he was indicted on the charges on September 28th for allegedly funneling corporate money to Texas legislative candidates in violation of state law. Some House Republicans have called for new leadership elections next month if the case isn't resolved by them. DeLay and two associates, Jim Ellis and John Caliandro, are accused of taking $190,000 in corporate donations, which under Texas law can't be spent on state races, and spending the money to an arm of the Republican National Committee. The National Party subsequently donated a total of $190,000 to seven Texas Republican candidates.
Not a moment too soon, striking transit workers in New York City now have a contract on which to vote. This after the resumption of negotiations between the Transport Workers Union Local 100 and their employer, the Metropolitan Transit Authority. The contract comes 5 days after the initial agreement was reached to end a 3-day strike that crippled New York's commute last week. It was the first work stoppage by MTA workers in 25 years. In New York, Ian Forrest has the story for Free Speech Radio News.
The announcement came late last night when Roger Toussaint, president of TWU Local 100, delivered this statement.
Our local executive board, by a vote of 37 in favor and 4 against, with 1 abstention, voted overwhelmingly to approve the proposed contract presented to our board and to forward that contract to the 33,000 members of Local 100 for ratification.
Among key provisions of the three-year contract are wage increases of 3, 4, and 3.5% in years 1, 2, and 3, a contribution of 1.5% of their wages into the cost of their health coverage, there being no differentiation in the pension plan scheme between older and newer workers, a major sticking point which seemed to cause the walkout in the first place. Another is that Martin Luther King's birthday will now be a paid holiday for MTA workers. David Harris is a train operator. FSRN spoke with him on day 3 of the transit strike. If he and the union's executive board are any benchmarks to go by, a yes vote for the deal is likely.
Well, you know, whatever my union get, I'm going to accept. See, but I really understand, you know, where Tucson is right now. I have 3 sons. They may be transit workers one day. So he's actually fighting for my children. He's fighting for your children. He's fighting for your neighbor's children. And the people don't really understand that. You know what I'm saying? He's fighting for all the unions, not just TWU. He's fighting for all the unions.
Whether that will be amenable to his colleague Antonio Robinson, a cleaner with the MTA, is to be seen. Before the strike, he was clear about what would be acceptable to him.
We are not going to accept anything less than 15%.
What is the city offering?
3% over the next 27 months.
The question of whether the strike was worth it will be answered once heavy fines imposed upon the union have been paid. Under the Taylor Act, employees considered critical to the day-to-day functioning of the state are prohibited from going on strike. Robinson, Harris, and many other MTA employees have already lost 6 days' pay. In addition, they have to deal with replenishing the TWU's virtually exhausted treasury, which was all but wiped out after the union was fined $1 million a day for each day the strike lasted. And after 3 days of getting around by whatever means necessary, New York City residents are being thanked by their governor, mayor, and the president of Local 100 for enduring the strike. Many in the city, though, question the significance of it all. Choreographer Jane Abrams is not one of them. She believes organized labor had a point to make.
I support the transit workers. They're fighting for a middle-class way of life. Anybody who's willing to work an honest job, work hard, shouldn't have to raise their families in poverty. Everybody's running around saying, I don't make that much, other people don't make that much, they're asking the wrong question. They should be saying, why can't I raise my family on a middle-class income if I'm willing to work hard?
Another woman, though, felt differently.
They make discriminate among white and black. Shame for them. They now love America.
While it is unclear when ratification of the contract by the rank-and-file membership of the union is to take place, what is clear is that the contract expires well outside the Christmas season. If accepted in its current form, this contract will be for 37 months, expiring on January 15, 2009. Reporting for FSRN in New York, I am E.
The U.S.-led international military coalition in Iraq shrank further yesterday after Bulgaria and Ukraine completed troop withdrawals and Poland announced it was reducing its contingent 40% while switching to a non-combat role. Responding to appeals by U.S. officials, the Polish government reversed an earlier plan to remove all of its troops by the end of the year. But officials of the East European nation said the 900 remaining soldiers of its previous 1,500-strong force would focus almost exclusively on training Iraqis as they wind down their mission over the next year. America's partners in the Coalition of the Willing, as the Bush administration has dubbed it, have dwindled from a peak of 38 nations and 50,000 troops in mid-2003 to 27 countries and about 22,000 troops currently, according to a recent State Department tally. Most of the remaining countries have announced that they will end their participation in 2006. Because only the 8,000-member British force plays a substantial combat role, the disappearance of the international contingent would not be a major military setback for the United States. But the departures represent a political setback for the administration because foreign troops help lend international legitimacy to the effort to build a new Iraq.
The television commercials are attention-grabbing.
Newly found Iraqi documents show that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, including anthrax and mustard gas, and had extensive ties to Al-Qaeda. The discoveries are being covered up by those, quote, willing to undermine support for the war on terrorism to selfishly advance their shameless political ambitions, close quote. The hard-hitting, if factually incorrect, spots are part of a recent public attention's barrage aimed at reversing a decline in public support for President Bush's handling of Iraq, sponsored by Move America Forward, a media-savvy advocacy group that has become one of the loudest and most controversial voices in the Iraq debate. While Bush now publicly acknowledges his mistakes the administration has made in judging the threat posed by Hussein, the organization is taking to the airwaves to insist that the White House was right all along. Move America Forward has no officially acknowledged formal ties to the White House or the Republican National Committee, and the group says that it operates independently from the RNC. Still, the organization provides a clear benefit to the administration by spreading a pro-war message that goes well beyond what administration officials can say publicly.
NBA superstar Shaquille O'Neal laughed at this idea. Diaper-clad men of gargantuan size summoned as battering rams to make the NBA's most imposing big man even better. Don't laugh, Shaq. It might happen. Coach Pat Riley of the Miami Heat is talking about adding extra bulk, and he means real tonnage, to Miami Heat practices. Riley's idea? Sumo wrestlers. In Riley's eyes, there isn't much difference between sumo wrestling and the way teams defend his 7'1", 340-pound center. Matches between sumorati's dressed in mashanis, diapers in the vernacular of the uninformed, typically last 10 to 15 seconds, with two massive men pushing and shoving, trying to knock the other from a circular area. Defending Shaq is essentially the same concept. Riley divulged his plan Sunday after the Heat beat Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers 97-92, a game where O'Neal struggled a bit offensively, shooting 8 of 18 and finishing with 18 points.
The current time is 5:37. And now, daily commentary from Jim Tower.
Maybe you're one of the 2 million Americans who've recently had their jobs offshore to India, Pakistan, and elsewhere. Or one of the millions more expected to have your job shipped abroad in the next few years. If so, don't worry, bucko, for a new growth industry has arisen that offers exciting job opportunities for you discarded Americans. You, too, could become an American accent and culture trainer. It seems that while such corporations as Citibank, Dell, GE, and Microsoft are eager to abandon the U.S. and move their telephone service jobs to low-wage workers abroad, these English-speaking foreign workers are, well, foreign. So their accents and cultural references can be jarring to U.S. customers placing orders or seeking help. Thus, offshoring companies are hiring Americans to teach foreign replacement workers to sound and behave like Americans. Yes, this means you could end up teaching the Indian or Pakistani or Russian who was given your job how to sound like you. Courses in American Culture 101 include U.S. history memorization, American slang, basic sports knowledge, and pop culture. Quick, what's the Lone Star State? Who are the Florida Marlins? Can you name one talent that Britney Spears has? What's a burrito? The lesson plans for these courses include having to watch episodes of Friends and screening such films as Bruce Almighty. As for accents, there are voice exercises for Indians, for example, to help them lower their natural high-pitched and clipped pronunciation of English. And if the exercises are not enough, the corporate call centers use technology to filter the telephone voices of the foreign service reps, making them sound lower than they are. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, it won't be long before the corporations train low-paid foreigners to teach American accents and culture to foreign workers. Then there'll be no need for American workers at all. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
You come through in every little thing you say you'll do. Baby, you come through.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear The Underground. And at 7, it's Nonstop Hip Hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, look for occasional showers with lows around 40 degrees. And tomorrow, more rain, There'll be a chance of showers, and otherwise, there'll be clouds in the sky. Highs 45 to 50. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
But baby, you're a giver, and you're giving me a love that's so reliable. Yes, it's undeniably true that you bring the sweet.
In a blow to Iraq's Sunni Arabs, a United Nations official today stated publicly for the first time that the results of the recent parliamentary election were firm, and he ruled out holding another vote, a demand set forth by some Sunni groups. The announcement, made at a press conference in Baghdad, was a fresh setback for Iraq's Sunnis, who claim that ballot box stuffing and their fraud were widespread and that the results have been distorted. The United Nations provided assistance to Iraq's election commission, which ran the vote, and its public show of support bolstered the authorities' claim that the vote was largely legitimate. The spokesman for the main Sunni alliance, the Iraqi Consensus Front, which has been particularly vocal in its criticism of the results, said that his group rejected the conclusion put forth by Mr. Jenness and that they would continue to press their demands for a substantial revamping of the vote. Several Sunni parties, as well as some secular groups, have called for authorities to hold a new vote, but that demand looks increasingly unlikely to be met.
Kurdish leaders have inserted more than 10,000 of their militant members into Iraqi army divisions in northern Iraq to lay the groundwork to swarm the south, seize the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, and possibly half of Mosul, Iraq's third-largest city, and secure the borders for an independent Kurdistan. 5 days of interviews with Kurdish leaders and troops in the region suggest that U.S. plans to bring unity to Iraq before withdrawing American forces by training and equipping a national army aren't gaining traction. Instead, some troops who are formally under U.S. and Iraqi national command are preparing to protect territory and ethnic and religious interests in the event of Iraq's fragmentation, which many of them think is inevitable. The soldiers said that while they wore Iraqi army uniforms, they still considered themselves members of the Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia, and were awaiting orders from Kurdish leaders to break ranks. Many said they wouldn't hesitate to kill their Iraqi army comrades, especially Arabs, if in a fight for an independent Kurdistan erupted. The Bush administration and Iraq's neighbors opposed the nation's fragmentation, fearing that it could lead to regional collapse. To keep Iraqis together, the U.S. plans to withdraw significant numbers of American troops in 2006, and it will depend on turning U.S.-trained Kurdish and Shiite militiamen into a national army.
Some Kashmiri analysts say the proposal created by the U.S.-based Kashmir Study Group is the foundational document for the United States of Kashmir proposal. That's the current plan that Indian and Pakistani officials will be going over. Since 1998, Ambassador Teresita Schaffer has been a member of the Kashmir Study Group, a non-governmental body made up of mostly U.S. academics, foreign policy specialists, and former congressional members who came together to propose a peaceful approach to addressing the conflict over Kashmir. Selena Masuto of Free Speech Radio News spoke with Ambassador Schaffer about the group's proposals.
Second proposal earlier this year that explores the concept of creating 5 self-governing entities in the Kashmir region. In 2000, when the group put out their first proposal, it was controversial amongst Indian and Pakistani officials because of its focus on sovereignty of Kashmir.
The term sovereign has aroused what, to my mind, is some unnecessary controversy in India. When it was used by the Kashmir Study Group, the phrase without international personality was intended to convey that this was not the same kind of sovereignty as the sovereign state of India or of Pakistan or of Greece or whatever, but that it conveyed a level of self-government that was more robust than what exists today. So this is something that is controversy and perhaps a little bit of misunderstanding.
What do you say to criticism of the Kashmir Study Group's influence in the United States government?
I know that it's become fashionable for people who like the Kashmir Study Group and for people who don't like it to see their proposals as kind of the hidden hand of the U.S. government. That's actually quite wrong. the U.S. government is aware of what it's doing, as they're aware of what lots of think tanks and independent groups are doing. But this is not U.S. policy by the back door.
Ambassador Teresita Schaefer, member of the Kashmir State.
A mass grave discovered yesterday in the western Indian state of Gujarat is believed to be one of those who went missing during the sectarian violence of 2002. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad for Free Speech Radio News.
Relatives of victims of the 2002 Hindu-Muslim violence in Gujarat claim to have exhumed skeletal remains from a mass grave in Panchmahal's district severely affected in the state, where many are still reportedly missing. Though the exact number of bodies is still unknown, after the site was sealed by the investigating agencies, eyewitnesses say it could be more than 20. The local administration has threatened to take legal action against those who dug up the site. The state police chief claims that the bodies have already been accounted for, autopsies performed, and that local officials afterwards buried the cadavers. Teesta Sitalwad of Citizens for Justice and Peace, an NGO working among the riot survivors, has filed a petition before the Gujarat High Court today.
If the police now tells us that these are the 21 missing persons and we have buried them properly, our only question is, why did you not intimate the relatives? Why didn't you give the bodies to them? Because that is the real procedure. In any religion, in any culture, performing of the last rites is emotionally very important, particularly when such dastardly crimes take place.
This week's discovery has brought back memories of the violence to the survivors, as over 2,000 cases are still pending in the courts. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Benu Alex for Free Speech.
Three unidentified assailants armed with automatic weapons attacked the prestigious Indian Institute of Science today, killing one professor and injuring at least five. The killed professor was identified as M.C. Puri of the Indian Institute of Technology, who had come to the Institute of Science to participate in an international seminar on operational research. The motive of the attack was not immediately established, but police sources pointed out that it might have a link with the presence of arrested mobster Abu Salem in the city. The IISC, set up in 1909, is India's premier institution of research and advanced instruction, with more than 2,000 active researchers working in frontier areas of science and technology.
The energy ministers of Ukraine and Russia failed to resolve a politically charged dispute today over Russia's plans to raise the price of natural gas exports to Ukraine. Russia is threatening to cut off supplies within days unless Ukraine accepts its demand to pay more than four times the current price for gas imports. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom national gas monopoly says it is prepared to shut off gas to Ukraine on January 1st, a major holiday in both countries, unless Ukraine accepts the price increase. About a third of Ukraine's natural gas comes from Russia, and Ukraine officials say rising the price from the current $50 per 1,000 cubic meters could cripple Ukraine's energy-intensive heavy industry and impede the country's effort to boost its economy. Ukraine's prime minister warned yesterday that Ukraine could divert some of the Russian gas supplies going to Europe, calling it Ukraine's right to take 15% of those shipments passing through its territory to European markets. Gazprom said such action would amount to theft.
President Vladimir Putin's outspoken liberal economic advisor, Andrei Ilyarinov, announced his resignation today in protest of what he called an end to political freedoms in Russia. Ilyarinov has long been the highest-profile critic within the Kremlin of the Putin administration, in particular slamming the breakup of the giant oil company Yukos and the imprisonment of its founder Mikhail Khodorkovsky on what critics called politically motivated charges. He described the Yukos takeover in 2004 as the scam of the year. Analysts said that Ilyarinov had already lost influence in the Kremlin's inner circle, but was kept on as a liberal fig leaf to ease Western concerns about growing state control over the economy and Putin's domination of the political system. In January of this year, he lost his job as the Kremlin's point man on relations with the influential Group of Eight, which takes over chairmanship of the G8 next year. Once in the Kremlin, he repeatedly took an independent line in Moscow politics, notably opposing the government's support for the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, which Russia ratified in 2004. He challenged the scientific and economic data on which the treaty is based and said it would lead to a fall in economic growth.
A prison uprising is now in its third day in the Brazilian city of Porto Velho. Shannon Young has more for Free Speech Radio News.
A group of prisoners took control of the Urso Branco facility on Christmas during visiting hours.
and continue to hold approximately 200 hostages, mostly prisoners' relatives. They are demanding the return of Ednildo Paula Sousa, an inmate who was transferred from the prison last week after his recapture following a successful jailbreak earlier this month. Sousa is said to have led a prison riot in April 2004 that resulted in 14 inmate deaths. The Urso Branco prison is severely overcrowded, holding around three times more inmates than it was initially designed to house. A crisis management team is negotiating for the release of the hostages, including 11 prison guards.
Residents in Argentina's central province of Cordoba may soon face a 200% hike in water rates, as Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires for Free Speech Radio News.
Cordoba's mayor passed a bill to increase water utility rates for users by 200% beginning this new year. The increase was passed as an initiative for the provincial government to forgive debt from Suez, the French multinational that controls Cordoba's water utilities. The provincial government also renewed Suez's concession, or right to manage the local water company. Suez has controlled Cordoba's water utility for 8 years and has threatened to pull out of Argentina because of a freeze on water rates. The provincial government agreed to forgive the company's $19 million debt so that the company could make long overdue investments. But instead of performing maintenance work or expanding water lines, Suez will first invest in installing 150,000 water meters to control and restrict the use of water. This has many residents upset. Local organizations, environmentalists, and residents will rally next week against the 200% rate increase and privatization of their water. Local groups are pushing an alternative initiative to make water accessible for all residents by lowering rates and building water lines for many neighborhoods without running water. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Roger Lonram stood tall and proud in the settle of Central House at the end of the Paddy Power dial-a-bet chase yesterday and waved his whip at the packed grandstand. He was celebrating his first win as a professional jockey and in a grade A event, too. Just for good measure, he swung a looping underarm punch into the air. There was just one problem, though, with this picture of sporting delight. They still had 80 meters to run in the race. Lowran had mistaken the end of the running rail for the winning post, and he eased up on his horse, Central House. High Cloy and Fonda Island, other two horses, galloped past him and relegated him to third place. It was an extraordinary, humiliating error, which briefly reduced the crowd to near silence. Some catcalls followed soon afterwards, but as Longhorn returned to the paddock to unsaddle, there was more sympathy than anger. Lungran, who refused to offer any comment on the incident, was called before the stewards and banned from riding for 14 days, which effectively rules him out for most of January. However, he will be free to ride Central House in the Queen Mother Champion Chase at Chehalaham in March, a race in which, on yesterday's form, he has a serious chance.
City leaders promised the world a new Beijing when they won the right to host the 2008 Olympics. Now, 4 years into the capital's makeover, it seems they've decided that what is really missing aren't broad parks or elegant hotels. Rather, what's missing is common courtesy. Beijing's Communist Party leadership has called for a full-blown campaign to improve etiquette and politeness ahead of the expected deluge of foreign visitors. Foul-mouthed taxi drivers have been called on to clean up their acts, and rowdy soccer fans to show more sportsmanship toward the opposing team. The next step to tackle, the powers that be have decided, is the art of standing in line. Trying to bring a bit more harmony to rush hour chaos are people like Gao Shuang, a retired family planning worker who now bears the title of Deputy Director of the Office of Coordinating Group for Orderly Bus Riding. Gao and her colleagues have been charged with improving the 10,000 bus stops in Beijing and its suburbs, the key points in a public transportation system that serves a population of more than 15 million people. Her office's uniformed monitors have spread out to staff 533 stops, helping make change for bus fares, assisting the elderly and handicapped, rescuing lost items, and, most importantly, getting passengers to stand in line.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 28, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mistletoe Angel. Tonight's audio editor is Andrew Geller. Special thanks to reporters Sheila Whiteside, Andrew Norris, and Andy Seaton. And our adorable headline reporters are Joshua Olmsted, Sakura Hayden, and Maggard Reed. Our engineers are T.A. Norris and Eduardo de Landros Thierry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving.
And I'm Brian Prince.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 28th of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The Osage Nation of Oklahoma held a landmark vote last month that gives the Osage people the right to decide their own form of government and their own membership criteria. As Kim Pappin, a member of the Osage Nation, tells us, it's the first time since 1906 that the Osage have exerted their true sovereign right to govern themselves due to the passage of a 2004 bill.
In late 2004, President Bush signed House Bill H.R. 2912, which officially reaffirmed Osage sovereignty. Although the Osage Nation has been federally recognized for over 100 years, we have not been allowed to decide our own form of government or membership criteria. Principal Chief Jim Gray.
It wasn't just the right to determine our membership that issue, it was also to determine our own form of government. And if you don't solve both of them at the same time, you're not going to be able to achieve anything close to what we all want, which is a form of democracy that's truly Osage.
You have to travel back in history almost exactly 100 years to understand how and why these kind of things happen.
Federal government just did away with the old government, and they appointed their own, and they wrote what's called the 1906 Act.
That's Tribal Council member Mark Freeman. The 1906 Act he speaks of was set up due to large quantities of oil that were found on the Osage Reservation. The government gave certain people rights to the minerals, commonly referred to as head rights. Only individuals with a head right have been allowed to vote since that time. Freeman is 85 years old, and he's been involved with the Osage Nation his entire life. But until a little over 10 years ago, when his mother passed and he inherited her head right, he wasn't allowed to have any say in the tribe.
I was 73 before I was eligible to vote in an Osage election. I'd take my wife and my mom up there, and I couldn't even go in there where they were voting. I wasn't allowed.
Our tribe has been governed by the 1906 Act until just this year. On November 19, 2005, the Osage people held the first of three referendums to set up our own constitution and our own membership criteria. It's been decided that lineal descent rather than blood quantum will be the basis for enrollment in our tribe. Also, we've decided that being a member of another tribe does not exclude you from gaining membership into the Osage Nation. These outcomes may seem vastly different from the way other tribes are run, but as Councilman Freeman states, they truly represent the beliefs of the Osage people.
That legislation that we got through, that saved our tribe. Now, if we as a people throw some of it away, it'll be our own fault. But we have our sovereignty. You know what sovereignty is. It's strength. It allows you to govern yourself. It allows you to make your own decisions and to make your own mistakes.
The next referendum is scheduled to be held in February and will further solidify the choices of the Osage Nation. For Independent Native News, I'm Kim Pappin.
A ruling released Tuesday by the Connecticut Supreme Court states that a member of the Mashantucket Pequot tribe must pay state income taxes. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
Mashantucket Pequot tribal member Joanne Dark Eyes had claimed she did not have to pay Connecticut state income tax, even though her home is not on the tribe's reservation, but on land owned by the tribe. Tribal members pay federal income taxes, but those who live and make their income on a reservation are exempt from state income taxes. In 2003, a state Superior Court judge ruled that Dark Eyes must pay more than $150,000 in back state taxes. The state Supreme Court has now upheld that ruling, claiming that under federal law, states have the authority to tax tribal members who live off the federally recognized tribal reservation. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, engineers and scientists concerned with the earth, RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a multi-regional, multi-tribal federal corporation serving Indian Country. Amerind-Corp.org. Independent Native News is a production KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairfield.